This is the State of Things live from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. New reporting from Rewire.news shows what some are calling alarming communications between U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and a separate U.S. Immigration Service agency. Documents they obtained show coordination between the two agencies in the detention of Samuel Olivar Bruno. Samuel had been in sanctuary in Durham for almost a year until ICE agents took him into custody at a biometrics appointment. Tina Vasquez is senior reporter on immigration for Rewire.news. She's been following the story and she's with us now. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back a little and remind us about Samuel's story.
So Samuel's wife has lupus. Her name's Julia. And so it was primary to Samuel that he be able to get out of sanctuary and help take care of her. And so that's why he was applying for deferred action at USCIS. Duke University law students were helping him apply, and they reached out to ICE days before the appointment on November 23rd, and they asked ICE if they could do a mobile biometrics appointment because Samuel was very concerned that he would be detained. And the field office director for Raleigh-Durham, Jay Wesselman, said that Samuel didn't have a reason to do a biometrics appointment mobily and that he would have to come in if he wanted to apply. So Samuel went, and within minutes he was tackled to the ground in front of his family and friends and the congregation, and he was detained and very quickly deported.
Well, tell us a little bit more about his sanctuary and when that began and how that began, how that came about.
So interestingly, I only recently learned there was another woman in sanctuary in Winston-Salem where I live named Minerva Garcia, and she was in sanctuary for a few months. And when she was released from sanctuary, I did not know this story until recently, Samuel approached her and said, you know, I'm being targeted for deportation, should I do this? And she said, save yourself, enter the church. And so he did. He was at Citywell Church for 11 months when he tried to apply for deferred action.
All right, and so, and then by applying, this appointment was one of the things that's required for you to stay in the country legally.
Yes.
He didn't have the documentation, but there are these legal requirements. He wanted to meet that requirement to go in for this biometrics appointment. Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about that, because you talked about asking ICE, but you go into a different office for this appointment, right? So
yes.
What office is that?
So U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, was typically, historically, thought of as like the services arm of immigration agencies under the Department of Homeland Security. So if you were applying for an immigration benefit, like deferred action, if you wanted to adjust your status and become a naturalized citizen, that's what USCIS was there for. But under the Trump administration, we see very alarming ways that they now appear to be engaging in immigration enforcement with ICE.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, because you've come up with some documents that show there was communication between ICE.
So I interviewed Samuel, I want to say a week or two after he was deported, and he was very strong in his opinion that USCIS and ICE collaborated to detain him, and that is something that his family asserted also. And so I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, or a FOIA, and I asked for any communication between USCIS and ICE regarding the detainment of Samuel. And a few weeks later, I received a response. It was only two pages. It was heavily redacted, so I couldn't see USCIS's response, but I could see what ICE was saying. So on November 1st, almost 3 weeks before Samuel was detained, a person with ICE reached out to USCIS with a screenshot of a Facebook post for the grassroots organization Alerta Migratoria. And it was a post in which Samuel was asking for community support to go to this appointment because he was afraid of what would happen. And so ICE sent this to USCIS, to the field office director, Jay Wesselman, and asked, like, can you confirm that this is happening, that this appointment is actually, that these details are correct? I couldn't see what Jay said in response, but the ICE agent thanks USCIS and says that they're gonna pass the information along up to higher ups. And so that's what we learned, is that there was communication, and it does appear that ICE is also following Alerta Migratoria on social media, because on the screenshot of the post it says you like Alerta, indicating that whoever that ICE agent is, whether or not they're being transparent about who they are online, they're following this grassroots immigrant rights organization.
Now, that's not illegal, and no. you would expect for a law enforcement agency to be doing just that kind of police work, whether or not you like what they're up to. Fact is, you hope they're reading the papers and trying to find the people, if that's their job, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, there was a big report this week. The only sort of thing about it is that it might be, if they're not being honest about who they are on Facebook, for example, which is where this post came from. I think The Guardian this week had a pretty big report about the way that ICE agents are being dishonest about their identity online in order to carry out immigration enforcement. So pretending to be someone else or not showing who they work for and then strategically following certain people so as to carry out immigration enforcement or keep tabs. We don't know if that's what's happening, but I think that's the concern.
And the other concern is the chilling effect. Again, it's not illegal for ICE to be talking to U.S. citizen, the citizen immigration service, right? But they haven't done it in the past, and I think that's primarily because ICS doesn't really wants to become a wealth. They have a lot of work to do. Much of it is legal, working with authorized people. They don't want to scare people away. So it's in their best interest to say, look at, we have a policy of not working with ICE. That's now been compromised.
Yeah, I mean, recently there was a new policy implemented at USCIS. So for example, if you are an undocumented immigrant and you are applying for an immigration benefit that you are not qualified for, and you it gets dismissed, you don't get the immigration benefit. What used to happen is if USCIS is now aware that you're undocumented without any authorization to be in the US, they would just kind of let it go, like nothing would happen. But now the policy is that if you don't get this immigration benefit and you're in the country without authorization, then that is a red flag and they pass that information on to ICE.
Now also this was on social media, so whether or not ICE is being honest about who they are when they engage with social media, the fact is it's out there for everybody to see. I mean, that is another question, right?
That was ICE's response. Brian Cox, who's the spokesperson for this region, said it was a public post, that's public information. You know, if you post something on social media, we have access to it just like everyone else. I think the bigger question is, why is ICE following this specific group and these particular people on social media, and is it for the express purpose of targeting people?
What about, what have you heard from other sanctuary seekers once Samuel's story became public? What's happening now out in the community?
It's been really, really overwhelming for them. So I continue to cover sanctuary, not just in North Carolina, but in Philadelphia, where there are a number of families in sanctuary. I've been visiting with them for stories that I'm working on. And the first day that I was there earlier this month, that's all that they wanted to talk to me about. They wanted to know what was in this FOIA, what did it look like, could that happen to me? Expressing concerns that I will never leave this church unless I have a guarantee that nothing will happen to me or ICE will come to me. So everybody was really alarmed. Even people who have been out of sanctuary started calling their friends that are still in sanctuary and checking them on them, because I think it it was really harmful to people and it really, really frightened them.
ICE obviously has an interest in discouraging sanctuary. North Carolina has become one of the bigger sanctuary states, so that could be part of the policy. But the broader question is, in the community, even outside the sanctuary community, in Latino communities around the state, does this kind of story have an impact on them?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't know if certain people saw sanctuary as an option for them, or I don't know if they knew it was an option. This is a movement that emerged in the 1980s, a very similar situation that we see today, where large numbers of Central American asylum seekers fleeing the Civil War there were coming to the United States, and they were being targeted for deportation, and they feared for their lives and their countries of origin, and so they sought asylum. And so, while being in the church and sanctuary, and so now you see this happening again in Philadelphia. There is a Jamaican family in sanctuary in the same church as a woman who's from Honduras. This is happening nationwide, and this is only going to continue happening as people continue to be targeted for deportation.
I want to switch subjects here because there's a bill making its way through the North Carolina legislature, House Bill 370, that would require sheriffs in the state to work with ICE. The bill passed in the House, has not yet passed in the Senate. Tell us what this bill would do.
So it would essentially require law enforcement officials across the state to collaborate with ICE, and that means honoring these ICE detainer requests. They're not legally binding. They're not legally required. Federal courts have actually ruled that they're unconstitutional, because what they require is if a person is in law enforcement custody and they're supposed to get released, if there's been some sort of resolution to why they were there, whether they bond out or whatever, what ICE does is they send a request and they say, hey, can you hold that person an additional 48 hours until I can come pick that person up? And that person has no reason to remain in jail for two more days. But the law would force jurisdictions to do that.
And there's been some, maybe a little bit of confusion about what's happening in here in Guilford County, because there is a requirement that if the individual who's being held for whatever reason is found to have been convicted of another crime, that would be a reason to contact ICE. Talk about what that means in here in Guilford County.
So there was some information circulating online that Guilford County had a new policy when it came to these ICE detainer requests. But I learned from speaking to Guilford County Sheriff's Office that that wasn't a new policy. They've always required a judicial warrant. So a warrant that's signed by a judge, if that's accompanied with a detainer request, then they would honor it. They would hold the person. But if it's not accompanied by a warrant, so Guilford County communicates with ICE and basically tells them up until the point that person is leaving information about the undocumented person in their custody. But what Guilford County won't do is they won't hold the person for ICE. So while ICE can be informed that this person is being released at this date on this time, and that's information Guilford County shared, whether ICE shows up or not is on ICE, but Guilford County is not going to hold that person longer.
Tina Vasquez is senior reporter on immigration at Rewire.news. Thank you so much for being with
us,
Tina.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, we talk to the descendant of a Confederate general, Robert E. Lee, who is fighting for social justice. We'll talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But first, the music of Andy Eversole. Andy.